clerk will call the docket.
John Jerome, deputy, Don Duckwell, against Virginia State Bar, Robert E. Graves, the appellant, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Rose Buford, now Deputy Attorney General, Nicholas S. Amato, Senior Assistant Attorney General, E. Scott Moore, Assistant Attorney General, the appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Bob Drain, and I'm here on behalf of Jerome Negondo, a member of the Virginia State Bar for almost 10 years, who had no disciplinary record whatsoever prior to these proceedings, and whose license to practice law in Virginia was revoked by an order initially of the disciplinary board that was literally a cut and paste from the bar's petition, and that even the bar and the board itself acknowledged contained multiple errors. It was only after we filed a notice of appeal, a long list of assignment of errors, pointing out the many errors, that the board issued a second order that still contains multiple errors that are the subject of this appeal. As an initial matter, the disciplinary board's order should be reversed because Mr. Negondo timely exercised his right to a three-judge panel by filing an answer and a demand that the proceedings be before the three-judge panel pursuant to 54.1-3935. He included in his written demand a statement as to his availability, and he indicated that due to his daughter's serious illness, his wife's cancer, his own court dates, his earliest available date was February 12th, and he said almost every date after that would work. His statement did not waive his right to a three-judge panel under paragraph 13-18D5. To the extent that there's any ambiguity in that rule, we suggest that it should not be construed against him. It's really not at all clear what's meant by available dates. He stated his available dates. It doesn't say he has to provide dates. It uses the term available dates, and he provided his available dates. This court in the...
Can I interrupt you for a second, though? I don't know where the ambiguity is. It says provide available dates for a hearing not less than 30 days nor more than 120 days from the date of the order. And if you don't do that, according to the rule, you've deemed to have consented to the jurisdiction of the board.
And that is the language, but it used the term available dates, and so if one doesn't have available dates, is he not in compliance? The rule also says that the hearing does not even have to be within that time frame, and for that matter, it's not even the board that would set the hearing. It would be the three-judge panel. And you rule that provision that you read from is a scheduling mechanism.
Right, well, that's where waivers come from. You don't have to have an absence of jurisdiction, have a waiver. You can simply have a procedural default.
And I understand, but this attorney was certainly trying to comply. He's including provisions and available dates, and he's honestly saying what he views as his available dates. I don't think that should be a knowing waiver of his rights under the... And there was a subsequent hearing, by the way, on the bar's motion to strike. Pursuant to the bar's procedures, they're supposed to record all hearings, but they were unable to produce the recording because of the supposed technical glitch. But he indicated in the hearing that he would make it available if necessary. The written demand says what it says. Again, he's indicating what his availability is. He was trying to state that, and he gave very good reasons why he believed he wasn't available until later, including his wife's cancer and his daughter's serious illness. So I believe that he should have been entitled to the three-judge panel. And, of course, had the proceeding stopped and it proceeded before three judges, there wouldn't have been the proceeding that ended up with this order that is just replete with egregious errors that we've identified in this appeal. First, there's nothing criminal or deliberately wrongful within the meaning of RPC 8.4b with respect to Mr. Ngondo's communications with those two clients, Dr. Miami and Ms. Arabello. As to Dr. Miami, they had a dispute over $452, and it was Dr. Miami who called in writing and emails Mr. Ngondo any number of names: scumbag, degenerate, depraved, affirmative crisis. He accused Mr. Ngondo and his staff of committing a conspiracy to defraud. Dr. Miami said that his goal was to put Mr. Ngondo out of business. Mr. Ngondo didn't make any disparaging remarks against Dr. Miami. In fact, he said, let's tone down the rhetoric so we can discuss this dispute over $452. Mr. Ngondo merely said, he warned him not to file any unfounded complaint. He didn't even say don't file a complaint, not file an unfounded complaint. And he reserved the right to bring an action for defamation. As to Ms. Arevalo...
But isn't it a problem if you're not providing proper representation, and then when the client complains, you try to shut them down with threats of lawsuits and that kind of thing? I mean, it was a flat fee to domesticate the defendant and try to collect on it, right, for Dr. Miami?
Some of the clients, it was a flat fee. Some of it was hourly. An associate had told Dr. Miami that he believed that there was $450 of unexpended. Mr. Ngondo said he wanted to review that and determine whether or not. So there was a dispute over whether it was $452. There was no charge that there was incompetent representation of Dr. Miami. And by the way, none of the allegations here are that there was any cause of action that was lost or whatever as a result of anything that he did. But specifically, the issue is not an unethical threat of litigation if an attorney has a fee dispute, even if the attorney ultimately might end up losing. That's what the courts are for. So they had a dispute over $452, and Mr. Ngondo said that if there was any unfounded complaint filed, they just warned him against filing an unfounded complaint. There's nothing illegal or criminal about that. And by the way, the board found that those same statements did not violate RBC 3.4J, which really is the one that applies in the situation. With Ms. Arabello, that was...
May I interrupt you for a second? 3.4J has to do with fairness to opposing parties and counsel, not threatening your client with a frivolous lawsuit, but threatening the other side of the case with a frivolous lawsuit on behalf of your client.
Well, I believe it may be more general in the sense of taking a position, an unreasonable position. I don't know if it's direct.
Well, tell me where it says that. It says file a suit, initiate criminal charges, assert a position, conduct a defense, delay a trial, or take other action on behalf of the client when the lawyer knows or when it's obvious that such action would merely serve to harass and maliciously injure. Well, in this instance, it wasn't on behalf of the client. It was against the client. So why does that rule apply?
Well, and they found that it wasn't.
Well, you just said it did. I'm asking you.
No, I'm not saying that 3.4J does apply. It doesn't apply. My point is that it's not unethical under any rule, including the rule that they said it was unethical. It's not unethical for a lawyer where there's a dispute over a fee when the client is threatening a suit and threatening to put him out of business and calling him all kinds of disparaging names simply to say, don't file any unfounded complaint. Let's see if we can resolve this. And if you do, I'll reserve the right to file a defamation action.
What would be the basis for a defamation action?
Well,
you call people names all day long, and it may be uncouth and rude and whatever else and unwarranted, but how does that...
And he didn't. There, of course, was not any defamation action filed. He's simply saying he reserved the right to file.
Because the concern is this in terrorem effect of a lawyer telling a non-lawyer, I'm going to drag you into court with this expensive defamation lawsuit And the client doesn't know what the elements of defamation are. And so, you know, I'm trying to figure out what would even be the basis for saying I'm going to take you into court and sue you for defamation.
Well, it would depend on the circumstances. He's reserving the right to file. Obviously, if he files, he would have to allege the basis for defamation action. So he's simply saying, after Dr. Miami has said all these things and accused him of being involved in a conspiracy to defraud with his staff, saying that you know, he reserves the right to file a defamation action. In other words, if these kind of any false statements are made publicly, and so I think he's perfectly entitled to say that. I reserve the right to file a counterclaim if you make any defamatory statements. And as to Ms. Aravallo, there was a fixed fee for $800 to prepare a PSA. She took a charge back, and so basically she took back the $800, and so she refused to pay anything, even though the associate prepared the PSA, had multiple communications.
But it wasn't that it was a draft was all it was, right, of the PSA?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't the PSA just a draft, not a completed document?
It was a draft, and so and the only reason it didn't get finalized is because the client terminated the relationship.
Because this has dragged on for months and months and months, and she's trying to get divorced.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It was a timing issue, and again, we're not this issue on the appeal is not a finding relating to whether he was responsive, communicated appropriately. We're appealing the finding that the statement with respect to their exchange was a.
The bottom line is you have a very technical critique of the bar's findings, but it's against this backdrop that obviously informed the bar's decision. And to me, that's how can I ignore that also?
If all he did, what he did was, the backdrop was he believed reasonably that his firm was owed, if not the $800 some amount, as a matter of fact, even though she, at the time, said that she didn't believe she owed any money, on cross-examination at the hearing, she conceded that she owed money. Mr. Negando, that day, was the first day he was representing himself. He cross-examined her, and she says, I agree that I owe you some money, I just don't know how much. And so all he said, so the statement that the board said was a spurious threat of litigation was his statement that if she didn't pay, he would file a warrant and debt and generous to court. So how in the world can that be a spurious threat of litigation to file a fee claim when it's a legitimate claim, so legitimate that she ends up agreeing under oath that she owed something, and it would be up to the generous to court to decide, is it $800 because it was a flat fee, or is it some lesser amount because of quantum merit, because as you point out, it was a draft, and so there was work done. But the associate worked on the draft, provided a draft to her, communicated with her over what details should go into it, etc. So I would think the generous support would have awarded some amount on quantum merit, not zero, which is she initially said she owed, even though she later conceded she owed something. And so, again, the question on appeal is, was that a spurious threat of litigation where he merely said, if you don't pay, I'll file a warrant of debt and generous support? Again, that's what the courts are for.
I interrupt you with one last question? Why isn't the question on appeal, this man's license was revoked? He had 42 ethical violations, according to the State Bar, involving five clients. So where's your end game? Suppose we carve one or two off. What difference does it make? This is not a criminal conviction. The holding was simply, we're revoking your license on 42 charges involving five clients. Suppose you carve one or two off. I'm not sure where that gets you.
Well, first, I think it would be more than one or two.
Well, how many are there, by the way?
What we pointed out, I think, are the, frankly, the most more egregious of the findings, as for example, the
okay, three or four or five. Well, just tell me what's the end game. How do you get a revocation order reversed by an appellate court when there's a multitude of unappealed violations which would warrant revocation?
Okay. Well, and that's a good question. The answer is under your rulings in the two cases in particular that we've cited that were single sanction of revocation, where at least one, where only one of the particular violations is reversed, then what the court has done and does is remand for determination, okay, what's the appropriate sanction under any remaining findings.
So that's the win here? If we carve two of them off, we remand it back to the bar and say, there are 40 violations that we approve of, may do what you need to do.
Well, the violations that would remain on a remand, again, it's for determination by the board if you don't agree that it should have been before the three-judge panel. If it's before the three-judge panel, the entire revocation order from start to finish is vacated and it would go for proceeding before the three-judge panel. If it was not properly before the three-judge panel, then under your rulings, it would be remanded for determination by the board, okay, what would be the appropriate sanction? He's already...
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. You've answered the question. I appreciate
it. All right, your time has expired. Your time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Scott Ward. I'm here today for the Attorney General's Office and on behalf of the Virginia State Bar. As you've heard, we're here because Mr. Ngandu is complaining that his license to practice law should not have been revoked. And as you've also discussed with him, there were 42 separate violations, and there were five different clients impacted. This also impacted his interactions with the Virginia State Bar. It was not just with the client. And Mr. Ngandu's conduct demonstrated his disregard, his disrespect, and his dismissiveness of the rules of court and of the needs of his clients. The sanction was appropriate in this case, 42 violations, of which only a handful are challenged here. The number and scope of the violations demonstrate that he did not respect the rules and that he was a danger to the public as a practicing lawyer. The board acted appropriately in revoking his license. Assignment of error number one, we all spoke to quite a bit, and that is the request that he's made for a three-judge panel, but he didn't do it properly. He mentioned that the timing mechanism of scheduling, providing scheduling opportunities between the 30 and 100 day mark was nothing more than that, a scheduling mechanism, but that's not accurate. According to the Green case out of this court in 2007, this court said that is not jurisdictional as to the tribunal. The tribunal may set the hearing outside of the 120 days, but the language is mandatory as to the respondent. The respondent shall provide available dates within that 120-day period.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Hypothetically, respondent suffers a stroke. It's in a rehabilitation facility for, let's just say for purposes of the hypothetical, 121 days, but eventually fully recovers and is capable of responding. What would happen under those circumstances?
Well, I think the court may have had that in mind in their comments in Green. They said it's not jurisdictional as to the tribunal. The tribunal might have made the decision to exercise its discretion in a very dramatic case like the one that you've described. They're not constrained by that 120 days. The tribunal can provide an opportunity for the hearing to be held outside of that 120 days, but it is mandatory as to the respondent. The respondent is required to provide those dates. And so in a situation like what you've described, the person may come forward with evidence. In current times, they may come forward with evidence to say, I'm active duty military. I'm out of the country. And the tribunal would have the opportunity to exercise its discretion and to set that hearing outside of the 120 days. In this case, however, there were some serious situations that were presented to the tribunal, to the board, that there were serious health issues in Mr. Ngandu's family. But he also said, I have court dates I need to show up for. And I've prioritized those, the implication being, I've prioritized those over appearing in front of you.
Okay, now, change the hypothetical.
Yes, sir.
The tribunal says, thank you, sir. You've indicated you don't have any good days. You're going to have to be here. Courts do that all the time. Here are your dates within the 120 days. Show up, and if you don't, we'll proceed without you. The tribunal could have done that as well, could it have not?
I think that that might have been possible, and depending on the circumstances, it might be that we would be here discussing whether the tribunal abused its discretion in doing so. In the hypothetical that you presented previously, if there were reports from doctors or hospitals saying he's in a coma, then perhaps this court would determine that's an abuse of the opinion.
Well, again, I've changed the hypothetical now. He's not in a coma. He just simply says, I'm really busy, and the tribunal says, well, we understand that. Here's your date within 120 days.
And according to the rule, yes, sir, I think that they can say you need to be here, have someone here on your behalf, or we will proceed without you. Yes, sir, I think they could.
So, indeed, the rule is a scheduling mechanism.
The rule is mandatory. The language is very clear. The rule is mandatory as to the respondent. It's very clear. I don't see any ambiguity.
I know you don't because you're arguing for the Virginia State Bar. But
there's no ambiguity in the language, as Justice Kelsey pointed out earlier. There is no ambiguity.
Well, there might not be any ambiguity in the language itself, but if indeed it is a non-jurisdictional scheduling mechanism, then that would impact upon the potential upon how this court would view it.
Well, and as I say,
reasonable minds can differ. That you know, there is a reasonable attorney on the other side making a different argument.
Yes,
we're considering both sides.
And as to the jurisdictional facet, that does not apply to the tribunal. So the tribunal does have discretion to do something else. So, for example, I'm in a federal court trial for the next 4 months. It doesn't happen around here, but I understand it happens in some jurisdictions. And I am fully unavailable. It would prejudice my other client terribly for me to have to be there. There would be the discretion within the tribunal to make some concession to that. And if the tribunal said, nope, day 60, we pick it. You've got to be here or we're going to find against you on all counts. Although that's not the only option either. Counsel might appear on behalf of the respondent and bring in witnesses, bring in the former clients to provide testimony. There might be an opportunity to present the case on behalf of the respondent, even if the respondent was not able to be physically present.
Is the bar harmed in any way by a three-judge panel hearing the matter?
Both options are available to the respondent. The bigger concern here is that this case, and it is important to note, this case was being brought forward on an expedited basis. There was a genuine concern that Mr. Ngondo was a danger to the public.
Understood. But,
and so,
but would the bar have been harmed if the bar had gone ahead and appointed a three-judge panel on an expedited basis?
Either tribunal is equally susceptible to hearing the charges. I don't believe there's any bias, for lack of a better term, as to which tribunal would hear these charges. The problem here was that in order to obtain a three-judge panel, which is something that the respondent has to act to do, there is a requirement, a process to obtain that panel. And he didn't do that. And
the,
so
the process is not in a vacuum. The point of this is to protect the public.
Correct.
And the more delay you have, the more risk there is to the public if you have a lawyer who's
has he had
issues.
Someone who was putting this off. That is the perception. He was putting this off as long and as far as possible. I don't have to.
My only question is, could the bar have prevented him from putting it off by appointing a three-judge panel on an expedited basis? You didn't give us any dates. Here's your panel. Appear in front of them within 30 days.
Except that he didn't trigger that, sir.
Okay. That much is apparent. But could the bar not have done that on its own when he did not?
There is no process for that, no, sir. The disciplinary board hears all proceedings unless the respondent triggers the appointment of a three-judge panel, which is actually done by this court. A request has been made of this court for a three-judge panel to be appointed and for active judges in the Commonwealth to set aside their other responsibilities and participate in a three-judge panel in the disciplinary process, which is important, which is why they do it. But it's only done when the respondent takes the appropriate actions and files the appropriate paperwork to trigger that event.
So the bottom line is the bar can waive the waiver if it chooses to, but it's got to use good discretion, just like a trial court denying a motion for a continuance or something like that.
Yes, sir. And as I mentioned, I think that there would be the potential if that discretion was abused for that to be raised to this court. It certainly is not the case here.
With respect to the discipline for delay in responding to the bar subpoena,
yes, sir.
Is the sanction in tension with the Rice case from this court that dealt with essentially if the bar hasn't suffered prejudice from the delay in responding to the subpoena, then discipline's not appropriate?
Well, sir, I would disagree. Because I think, Justice McCullough, what we have here is a situation where there is a pattern and practice of disregard for the rules. And this is one example of that. But the failure to comply with a request for information in a disciplinary proceeding has multiple avenues by which the rules of this court and by which the rules of professional conduct address that specific conduct. It is perceived as particularly poor form to not respond to the
disciplinary. Right, okay, so, but if I'm, and maybe I'm misreading Rice, but what was the ultimate prejudice to the bar from this delay? I mean, did he not disgorge documents ultimately and get the information that you needed?
Well, I think in this particular case, for one thing, as I mentioned previously, we have an expedited proceeding that's been requested. Again, delay. So we have a situation where there's danger to the public and the bar is trying to bring this on promptly, and that decision that this should in fact be brought on in an expedited proceeding was never challenged, has not been challenged. So there's nothing to question that determination by the disciplinary board. Having made that determination that there is a danger to the public sufficient to expedite this entire proceeding, delay in and of itself is prejudicial. Yes. And he has seemed to argue that I wasn't administratively suspended, and therefore I'm immunized from any disciplinary action for failing to comply with these subpoenas in a timely manner. That's not how this works. Yes, an administrative suspension would have been a possible avenue of discipline, but a separate independent grounds for discipline is the 8.1 provision. And he managed to avoid, by a matter of days, administrative suspension on two different occasions. But that does not immunize him from the 8.1 discipline. And that was appropriately imposed in this case. Have I answered your question?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. Now, as to the individual violations that were set out, of course, there's a fairly stringent standard of review. The facts are given a great deal of deference, and in fact, the sanction is given deference, unless there's an abuse of discretion by the board. But on the specific findings of violation, you all had a lot of questions about the threats to Mr. Ngandu's clients. Mr. Ngandu's clients, who were not attorneys, who came to him for assistance, who were having a great deal of difficulty getting their matters pursued appropriately and timely, terminated the representation. And what they were confronted with in that is a refusal to refund fees, the fees that had been paid, and a threat of litigation. Ms. Arevalo, she even suggested using the state bar's fee dispute resolution structure to Mr. Ngandu. The client suggested that. And he responded to her with a threat of litigation. These are people who have come to him for assistance, and he is intimidating and threatening and manipulating their behavior with his knowledge of the legal system, and that's inappropriate. And more importantly, under the rules, it's wrongful. And it is, in fact, the exact conduct that 8.4b is designed to prevent. Wrongful conduct that adversely reflects on that lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, and fitness to practice law. This can't be how we treat our clients.
But how do we, I mean, the tightrope we have to walk is you're going to have even diligent, you know, lawyers, et cetera, with disgruntled clients who are making, and now the internet enables, I mean, it's a megaphone. And so we don't want to shackle the lawyers who are responding appropriately to defamatory statements or whatever. So how do we handle that?
And if, in fact, one of these people had, if it had been shown that they were doing something, he would have been entitled, just as any other individual would have been entitled, to file an action that's appropriate to the circumstances. That's not what happened here. He had a fee dispute with Ms. Arevalo. He had a fee dispute with Dr. Miami. And in the course of $400 dispute, $800 dispute, he's threatening $1 million action again and telling them, I'm going to drag you through court for years. That's what he's communicating, and he's communicating that in written communication. This isn't a heated face-to-face in the office, pounding the desk, gosh, I wish I could take that back. This is an opportunity for contemplation. This is an opportunity to type it up and take a look at it and send it anyway. In each of those cases, the conduct was wrongful, was deliberate, and it did not reflect well on his ability and his opportunity to practice law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Another really challenging set of assignments of error are 3 and 4 about Ms. Medina. I don't know if you specifically recall Ms. Medina, but she was the person who wanted to needed to participate in arbitration. And in conjunction with the other lawyers and the staff at the firm, Ms. Medina was deprived of that opportunity. It was delayed because they took her $2,800 arbitration fee that she paid, and they didn't pay it to McCammon. That money was never theirs. It wasn't a fee that was earned. It was never going to be earned. It was always going to go to McCammon. That was an arbitration fee. And yet, they didn't tell her she needed to pay it. The proceeding was delayed. Phone calls were canceled. The money was paid. They still didn't pay it over. It was canceled again. So she's waiting to try to get her money back, to get some resolution of her dispute with this car dealership, and nothing's happening except that she's paying more money. And she's entrusting this attorney and his firm with that money. And there was a comment that there weren't findings of fact. Paragraphs 30 through 50 of the order are complete with findings of fact relative to Ms. Medina and the conduct of both Mr. Ngondo and the lawyers in his firm.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.